There's a new provision that would state that if the minister, I think it's the Minister of Public Safety, identifies a group of two or more people coming as irregular arrivals, then they would be placed in detention for a minimum of 1 year.
How does the court system, the justice system, best ensure the facilitation of KB's evidence?
Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers from coast to coast at community radio stations. I'm your producer and host, Carly Forbes. In this edition, an analysis of how Bill C-31 will affect queer and trans refugees, and the Supreme Court of Canada dismisses a case where they deemed a woman with intellectual disabilities unable to testify about being sexually assaulted. But first, here's the headlines. Ms. Toussaint is a 42-year-old woman who has lived in Canada since 1999. She came to Canada from Grenada on a visitor's visa and worked to support herself, including paying for minor medical care when needed, until her health began to deteriorate. She's been fighting for her right to access health care since 2006. On April 6th of this year, the Supreme Court of Canada refused to hear her case.
My name is Nikki Bosnoff. I am an organizer with Health for All, which is a migrant justice organization based in Toronto.
The Supreme Court of Canada refused to hear her case.
Essentially, the decision that came on March 5th was that she had previously been denied access to the Interim Federal Health Program, which is essentially a program that covers health services. So it's not a provincial program like something like OHIP. What it is a federally run health program, and normally people who access health care under this program are refugees or asylum seekers. So she was applying for funding under the ISHP, as she had a humanitarian and compassionate immigration application underway, and essentially that decision, she was refused. So the most recent Supreme Court application was to see whether this was a matter of national interest, whether Canadians were interested in hearing her case and in considering whether someone like Ms. Toussaint, who currently is a resident but does not have a formal immigration status, should have access to health care.
And what does this say for other migrant people?
Well, I think the Supreme Court's decision is fundamentally unjust, and it essentially shuts out migrant voices, denying them access to health care. Nell Toussaint is only one of hundreds of thousands of people living in Canada. Estimates are up to 500,000 in Toronto alone, actually, who live in Canada without access to health care or have precarious access to health care. And as far as health care, Health for All is concerned, access to health care should be accessible to all, irrespective of their immigration status.
On April 12th, Kinder Morgan Energy announced further details of its plan to twin the existing Trans Mountain Pipeline system, which stretches from northern Alberta into BC, down the Thompson River through Kamloops, and to the Lower Mainland. This proposed double pipeline would allow the Houston-based company to increase the flow of oil coming from the oil sands from 300,000 barrels a day to as much as 700,000 barrels a day. Kinder Morgan says it intends to file an application with the National Energy Board in 2014 and is prepared to start breaking ground in 2016, with the project completion date set for 2017. This massive project joins the proposed Northern Gateway Pipeline as a way for industry to transport the more than 1.7 million barrels of oil a day from Alberta's oil sands to international markets. Travis Davey, spokesperson for the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers, said that in the future, the output of the oil sands is forecast to reach 3 million barrels a day by 2020 and 3.7 million by 2025, and that transporting this quantity of oil will require twice the combined extra capacity of the Northern Gateway and this Trans Mountain pipeline. The announcement of the Trans Mountain project has met with plenty of opposition from environmental groups and First Nations along the proposed route. The Sierra Club of Canada organized a No Tankers rally in Vancouver on March 26th, the 23rd anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Kinder Morgan has calculated that the increase in pipeline capacity provided by this second pipeline could result in a fivefold increase in shipper tank traffic, up from 70 to 365 oil tankers leaving the terminus per year. The Western Canada Wilderness Committee notes that each of these oil tankers could carry three times more crude oil than was spilled by the Exxon Valdez. In the past 5 years, Metro Vancouver has seen two pipeline spills in Burnaby in 2007 and 2009, and in January 2012, a spill in Abbotsford. The Tsleil-Waututh Nation, in whose traditional territory the proposed shipping terminal lies, have expressed their strong opposition to the project. Members of the nation still live with the consequences of a crude oil spill on their land that dates back to the 1950s. Chief Dustin George says that Tsleil-Waututh will assert their Aboriginal right and title and oppose the proposed development.
Native Friendship Centre of Montreal at risk of closing. After providing services, outreach, and cultural space to Montreal's urban Aboriginal community over the last 37 years, the Native Friendship Centre of Montreal, also known as the NFCM, could be at risk of closing in less than 3 months. According to the Native Friendship Centre of Montreal's Vice President of the Board of Directors, Gordon Bird, its possible closure is over a funding dispute with one of its core funding sources, which is from the Regroupement des Centres d'Amitié Autochtone du Québec, a subsidiary group of the National Association of Friendship Centres, which oversees 10 similar Aboriginal spaces. Earlier this year, the Native Friendship Centre of Montreal received a letter from Le Regroupement des Centres d'Amitié Autochtone du Québec, saying that it has decided to terminate the Native Friendship Centre of Montreal's membership. This lack of membership by Le Regroupement des Centres d'Amitié Autochtone du Québec will mean that the Native Friendship Centre of Montreal will not be eligible for funding from other sources, such as the federal government and Heritage Canada. The first casualty to take place due to the financial cuts to the Native Friendship Centre of Montreal is the recent closure of the Intertribal Youth Centre, a centre that provides services and resources for urban Native youth in Montreal. Gordon Bird says the Native Friendship Centre of Montreal is being targeted.
There's a lot of details that are complex that need to be brought into light in terms of why the centre is being targeted, because it is being targeted, in terms of infrastructure. There, a part of it is that they're saying we're not feasible, we don't have the ability to run the Intertribal Youth Center here under this roof, which is, that's not true. As we look to our youth, they see while they were here, they were very happy. You could see they were very productive. They have a lot of programs going forward. And when we had community events up here, those youth from downstairs would be up here.
That the Native Friendship Centre of Montreal's services focus on the homeless, people with substance abuse problems, and at-risk youth is at the heart of the conflict between the Friendship Centre and Le Regroupement des Centres d'Amitié Autochtone du Québec. Bird says that the RCAAQ would like to open a new Friendship Centre that would be focused more on family and cultural events and activities and less on outreach. Gore Bird says this change does not make economic sense and that the Native Friendship Centre of Montreal closure will put the lives of many Aboriginal people in Montreal that rely on its services on a daily basis at risk. The Native Friendship Centre of Montreal is appealing to the Department of Canadian Heritage, but there is no date set for a hearing.
Our next headline is about the Lifeline program. While conservatives are spending billions of dollars building more prisons, programs designed to help prisoners are being cut for not being cost-effective. Recently, the Correctional Services of Canada cut the Lifeline program, which was the only program focused on long-term offenders and lifers. Currently, 4,300 people are serving life sentences. Of this number, one-third are under parole supervision for the rest of their lives, while the remaining two-thirds will die in prison. Lifeline costs CSC $2 million a year, and they spend only 2% of their $3 billion budget on programming for inmates.
Peter Collins, who has been imprisoned for over 29 years, spoke about the funding cuts to Lifeline.
Kind of interesting, you know, how the Conservatives are removing Lifeline, which was, at least in theory, a prison mentorship program, which was designed to, you know, have prisoners out on parole help prisoners in the prison system walk out into the community. But an idea whose purpose was often used by the prison industrial complex as a sort of a wet blanket to be thrown over the release plans of prisoners in the form of delays. And it was, you know, in that regard, it just becomes this window dressing which props up a bad system. You know, essentially the recommendations made by Lifeline workers were not taken seriously by the parole board or the Corrections Canada. And it should be noted that, you know, people who are serving life sentences working for the prison industrial complex, you know, which is a system that resists people's release from prison, is a very complicated and sort of dangerous role for a parolee to be engaged in, you know, and the danger is on a personal level where they're expected to go back into prisons and talk and guide other prisoners. That must be really, you know, a very hard, soul-shaking role to take on. And from what I've heard, they never received any counseling to deal with that. But, you know, I'd prefer to see people, you know, if they're really sincere and committed to helping people, you know, get out of prison successfully, you know, that they do it with a non-governmental organization and not aligned with or paid by the prison industrial complex to help prisoners.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this break. Toronto, Ontario, from their new album, Siren Songs. Bill C-31 is a discriminatory immigration law that has been called the Refugee Exclusion Act. It imposes mandatory imprisonment for 1 year for so-called irregular arrivals and makes it possible to deport permanent residents if the country they came from is declared safe by the Conservative government. David Tassiam from CKUT's Off the Hour spoke with Ed Lee from Agir, an LGBTQ immigrant and refugee rights organization, about how many people are coming into Canada with refugee claims relating to sexuality, and how Bill C-31 may affect queer and trans refugees.
Well, there's one researcher, Sean Rehaig, who in 2004 located all of the refugee claims that are based on sexual orientation specifically. Now, that doesn't include people who are LGBTQ who might apply for refugee status based on other claims, not just based on sexual orientation, but also somebody, for example, from Rwanda could have applied because of the genocide that was happening there, but could also be LGBTQ. So the number doesn't include them, but I can't remember, unfortunately can't remember the exact number. It was over 1,000 over the course of 1 year. I think it was in 2004 or 2005. But I think overall with Bill C-31, one of the things that is the most worrisome is the fact that this bill is going to impact not just refugee claimants and accepted refugees, but also those who are accepted refugees who are now permanent residents. So those who have transitioned their status from refugee to permanent resident, all of those people who are not yet citizens will be impacted, potentially impacted, by some of the new provisions in Bill C-31.
They can go back and annul permanent residency.
Yep. Right. So what one of the clauses is called the cessation clause. And what this clause will do is that it would potentially give the government the power to identify permanent residents who were accepted refugees, so they could be here 5, 6, 7, 8 years plus, and if it is deemed that they're no longer in need of protection because their country conditions have changed. For example, if you're a trans refugee from Mexico and you have been a permanent resident for 3 years, if the government says, well, the country conditions have changed, there is now state protection for trans people, then they would have the power to say that their permanent residency would cease, and then they would have the power to deport that person.
But what if in the meantime these people have set up a life of their own and started to live
that
here?
People will have established their lives here. It's really hard to say to how far reaching the government will go to target permanent residents, but the problem is that it's possible. So it's possible for the government to identify certain countries as no longer threatening for specific groups of people, and then to say that their status should be revoked. There's a new provision that would state that if the minister, I think it's the Minister of Public Safety, identifies a group of two or more people coming as irregular arrivals, then they would be placed in detention for a minimum of 1 year without the possibility of review. There are already hundreds of people who are being placed in detention, refugee claimants, so not people who are identified as criminals or whatever, but refugee claimants who are being placed in detention now. And conditions in detention, which there's been a few new reports that have come out by researchers who have done, you know, reports, have talked about the psychological consequences, the mental health consequences of those who are in detention even for a day or two. And what this new bill would do is give the government the power to decide that some refugee claimants should be in detention for at least 1 year. And this would also include those who are 16, 17. For children who arrive with their mom, with their mother, who are under 16, they would unfortunately have to decide, do I stay in detention with my parent, with my mother for a year, or do I go into state care?
Guelph Prison Radio also spoke with Alicia Lim about Bill C-31.
They've got this whole new system. So I'm going to use the example of Hungary again. It's hypothetical because we don't know for sure who they're going to decide. But they have been threatening a lot to put a ban on people coming from European democratic countries. So let's say they decide that Hungary is a safe country. Well, the whole way that this system will make things so much more streamlined and efficient is that if someone even just comes in from Hungary, what they're going to do is immediately say, oh, you know, you're probably fake, so we're going to give you only 15 days to make your case about whether or not you deserve asylum. And of course, 15 days, like if you've already been traumatized by right-wing extremists, you know, possibly been subject to extreme violence, to yourself and to your family. It would be difficult for me to organize, I don't know, my taxes in 15 days, never mind, you know, proof that I deserve, like all of the medical certificates that I need, all of the legal advocacy that I would have to look for, all of the documents that prove, you know, where I'm from, when I'm from, all of my certificates. And on top of that, being pretty shaken emotionally is really inhumane to do in 15 days.
And now, a feature from AMI Audio's interview program, Contact, regarding a decision by the Supreme Court of Canada. In February, the High Court ruled on an appeal involving the case of a young Ontario woman with an intellectual disability, identified as KB, whose stepfather was charged with sexually assaulting her. The case was dismissed when the court decided the woman was not competent to give testimony when she was unable to explain what truth is. The case was appealed to the Supreme Court, who had to decide how the Canada Evidence Act should be properly interpreted when witnesses who are unable to, quote, communicate evidence, but are unable to provide an oath or an, quote, affirmation to tell the truth. The Women's Legal Education and Action Fund, or LEAF, and Dawn-RAFH Canada were interveners in the case. Both groups provided background information to the court regarding women with disabilities and access to the legal system. The court ruled that people like KB should give evidence even if they were unable to explain the literal definition of truth or a lie. This ruling, however, raises another question. Could the same questions asked of the defendant in the preliminary hearing be asked again with similar results? Joanna Bierenbaum, legal director for LEAF, explains.
No, asking questions that are similar to those that were asked at the preliminary inquiry is completely in keeping with what a defense counsel might do. But your question raises a larger issue, which is how does the court system, the justice system, best ensure the facilitation of KB's evidence? So the Supreme Court of Canada noted that KB's teacher, Mrs. W., of 6 years, was prevented from testifying or from giving evidence at trial on how KB communicates and what is the best form of questioning of her. And now that at least we're hopeful that this first barrier to access to justice for witnesses with mental disabilities has been overcome, and that they don't need to satisfy this additional test demonstrating that they can articulate an understanding of what a promise is and what truth or a lie is, we then need to consider, given the particular challenges faced by individual witnesses, because, of course, disabilities that any particular witness might experience are different, what do we put in place so that the best evidence that they can give is facilitated in court? Partly as a result of this Supreme Court of Canada decision, and partly because this work was already underway by community and disability equality rights organizations on the ground, there's been a move, preliminary move within Canada to try to set up something called a roster of witness intermediaries, which exists in other jurisdictions like the United Kingdom. And it's a roster of individuals with various areas of expertise, like speech-language pathologists, who are expert in assisting the witness in communicating and the court in understanding and best asking questions to facilitate that witness's evidence. So that's a really important piece that we really don't have in place in Canada in our justice system at the moment.
According to Bierenbaum, neither KB nor her family have decided to proceed with another trial. To hear the interview in its entirety, please visit AMI at AMI.ca and follow the contact link on the homepage. This is Elena Falcone of AMI Audio reporting to Groundwire.
And now for Groundwire's Community Radio Report.
The United Nations has given this year, 2012, a special designation. It's the International Year of the Cooperative. The designation is part of the UN's effort to raise public awareness about cooperatives and co-op culture and highlight the positive ways that co-ops benefit society. On April 24th, I attended the Southeast BC Regional Community Radio Conference in Nelson, BC. The conference was organized to celebrate the year and was put on by Kootenai Co-op Radio and the National Campus and Community Radio Station Association. Some 25 radio enthusiasts from 7 BC community and campus radio stations attended the event. The goal was to increase dialogue and resource sharing amongst the stations, and by providing a forum for people to meet and talk and learn from one another, the conference also aimed to equip attendees with the know-how to grow their stations and improve the content they bring their listeners. The day kicked off with a traditional greeting from Therese Alexis. Therese is a representative of the Sini Nation. She welcomed us to her traditional territory and wished everyone a happy and instructive workshop.
For offering tobacco to the north, to the east, the south, to the west, and for our sacred mountain, Frog Mountain, to the Warrican. And I just hope that you guys all have a really good conference and a great weekend here in Austin. So thank you. Limlet, 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 limlet.
We then broke into groups and attended the first of a series of workshops. The workshops covered a wide range of issues, from the financial side of running a station to advanced techniques in journalism. I attended a workshop on vocal technique. It was taught by Jay Hanley, the station manager at Kootenai Co-op, and Mark Stevens, a former commercial station broadcaster who now has a morning show on Kootenai Co-op Radio.
On the air, you can get rid of so many words and, if, but, you know, you can pull all of them out and just hit the main points. And coming through the radio, it sounds perfectly normal.
After another workshop, everyone met in a nearby community center where a wonderful meal prepared by KCR volunteers awaited us. In the afternoon, I went to a workshop on setting up a studio. It was led by Gregor Ash.
You're plugged into two channels because you need left and right. So in that case, you put the panning over on one side and over the opposite way on the other side, because you want to have this channel come out the left speaker and this channel to come out the right speaker.
The last workshop I attended was titled Meet the CRTC. It was a casual Q&A with Stephen Simpson, the CRTC Commissioner for British Columbia and the Yukon. Simpson talked about his career in radio, why he was chosen to be commissioner, and the mandate and nature of his work. This clip was provided to Groundwire by Mark Stevens.
When you buy spectrum, or when you're given spectrum as a broadcaster, you're being given a public piece of airwave that's a non-renewable resource. And the view has always been at the commission that if you're going to be given that spectrum, that if you build a business on it, and like capital gains, the business grows to a value that's significantly different than when you started, that there would be some form of a tangible benefit that's been accrued that we want a portion of to put back into the broadcasting system.
Everyone then gathered for a wine and cheese social. And after that, we walked to a local church where we attended a talk by David Barsamian. Barsamian is an acclaimed journalist and author whose program, Alternative Radio, is broadcast on community and college radio stations across the U.S. and Canada. The conference was roundly enjoyed by everyone in attendance and demonstrated the wonderful things that are possible when a community works together in pursuit of a common goal. A special thanks to all the organizers and billets. Reporting for Groundwire, I'm Joel Bard.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire. From Guelph, Ontario, I'm Carly Forbes. Music this week was by Abstract Random. Headlines this week were written by Leanne Arneson, Catherine Fisher, and Sydney B. We also thank Dee from Prison Radio CKUT, Maricol Kiao from Migrant Matters Radio, and Audrey O'Brien from CKUT. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, or download at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.